Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hi, everyone. Happy Friday. It is July 17th, and we have a very full episode for you, including an interview with Brad Feld of Foundry Group, who we very much enjoyed talking with earlier this week. Alex is going to get us started with Twitter.
On Tuesday, hackers compromised the Twitter accounts of dozens of prominent individuals, Joe Biden, Elon Musk, Mike Bloomberg, and Bill Gates, and companies, Uber, Apple, and the cryptocurrency platforms Coinbase and Gemini. The hackers posted tweets on these accounts, requesting users to send them Bitcoin with the promise of sending back double the funds in return. As it turns out, the scam only yielded $121,000 in Bitcoin payments, and it was remarkably amateurish. The hackers appear to have gained access to a company tool to manage accounts by either using social engineering techniques to seal employee passwords or merely paying off a Twitter insider. As Alex Stamos, former chief security officer of Facebook, told CNBC's Squawk Box yesterday, this attack was, quote, the equivalent of stealing a McLaren F1, taking it for a joyride, and then crashing it into a telephone pole 4 minutes later. There is so much more damage that could have been done. For example, imagine if they had posted promising news on Apple's account about a revolutionary new product announcement. Or, as the New York Times posed, what would happen if they had decided to take control of Joe Biden's account several days before the election and announce that he was dropping out of the presidential race? Another scenario, suppose they issued false warnings of a coronavirus outbreak in key precincts in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, thereby suppressing the vote in important battleground states. Fortunately, the perpetrators do not appear to be state-sponsored actors, but rather a ragtag group met on a site called ogusers.com, where hackers have met for years to buy and sell valuable social media screen names. They have even been corresponding with the Times. One hacker in his 20s disclosed that he still lives with his mother. Nevertheless, the damage that this kind of attack could have caused is substantial and will undoubtedly keep security experts up at night for many weeks and months to come.
What a week for Twitter. Another company in the headlines this week was Airbnb, which is reportedly still contemplating an IPO this year. According to the New York Times, its CEO, Brian Chesky, told employees on Wednesday that the company, which planned to file in March to go public, then was forced to abandon those plans when its revenue came to a crashing halt amid the pandemic, may be able to salvage a 2020 offering after all. On a video conference with employees, he apparently said that gross bookings had rebounded in recent weeks as the country and world had begun to open for business again. He reportedly said, "This is something I never would have imagined telling you. It kind of defies logic in a way." It certainly does. It's interesting to me that this conversation happened on Wednesday because I think it was pretty clear by then that the spread of COVID is actually getting worse, not better. I do think a lot of people who were contemplating travel plans to finally escape a bit this summer were probably shelving or limiting them in some way, especially in hotspots for COVID right now like LA and all of Florida. In fact, a separate story about the company said that it's still very much struggling when it comes to bookings in urban centers like New York versus more rural areas, which makes a lot of sense. It's easier to socially distance yourself outside a city. But it does impact a lot of its revenue. The vast majority of it, I'd presume, was from urban centers previously. So, what's going on? The company is under pressure from its workers to go public, as has been reported previously. Shares held by early employees will begin to expire this year. But also, as the Times noted, investors might just be willing to give this company a break. We've all seen the power of Airbnb. The brand is beloved. I think people assume that at some point, even if it's a year away, there will be travel and movement again, and a need for the types of offerings that Airbnb makes available. In the meantime, Erin Griffith of the New York Times had another interesting piece about Airbnb today, one in which she looks at its culture, which is much prized as inclusive and familial within the company, but that was frayed badly by a massive layoff in May when it cut 25% of its workforce, or roughly 1,900 people. One employee talked of a broader feeling of betrayal, which is a natural feeling that any laid-off employee might experience, of course. But it's not just full-time employees who are feeling bitter. Another 490 full-time contractors were cut back in May, executive pay was sliced, and certain divisions will never come back. My sense is that Airbnb was really talking to the times, in fact, to communicate that though it has had a terrible 4 months, it's also realized that it veered too far from its initial focus, with plans for luxury vacations and experiments with flights and even a print magazine. Chesky has apparently been talking lately of a second founding, in which Airbnb will be more focused on its core home rental business. Except this time, because the company will have little choice seemingly, it'll focus a little less on international travel, a little less on crowded cities, and much more on local trips and long-term stays.
On Wednesday, Google announced that it had finalized a $4.5 billion investment in Jio Platforms, the company behind India's largest telecom provider. Among other initiatives, Jio plans to digitize 60 million mom-and-pop stores in the country. This transaction followed Google's announcement on Monday that it was launching a $10 billion fund to invest in India over the next 5 to 7 years. The Jio deal will be the first investment of this fund. With another investment like Jio, Google may have to go back to the well much sooner than it had anticipated. India's market size makes it a big target for American tech companies. More than 500 million people in India are online today, and over 450 million smartphones are in active use in the country. Despite the fact that Google's revenue from India represented only 1% of its total revenue last year, India is growing rapidly. India will be adding around 171 million new wireless internet subscribers in the next 5 years, twice the number expected to be added in China and the U.S. combined. Another important driver is China, which has largely shut out American tech companies. Earlier this month, Google said it had abandoned plans to offer a new cloud service in the world's largest internet market. And despite Mark Zuckerberg's much-publicized efforts to learn Chinese, the social networking giant has not had much luck in launching its service there. Also, India is at odds with China because of a border dispute and recently banned a large number of Chinese apps and services, clearing the way for American companies to expand their service offerings without having to deal with Chinese competitors. Apart from Google, Facebook has also invested billions in Jio. In April of this year, it plowed $5.7 billion into the company. In addition, Amazon has invested $6.5 billion to help small and medium-sized businesses in the country come online. For American tech giants, it certainly seems like India is the place to be.
And finally, another week, another spate of venture funds that announced their newest vehicles. Among those worth noting, CRV, the early stage venture firm that is this year celebrating its 50th anniversary, just closed its newest fund with $600 million in capital commitments. The firm says it raised the fund entirely during the pandemic, which, no offense, CRV, but who cares? When you're on your 18th fund and have the kind of portfolio that CRV does, I'm sure it's a matter of a few phone calls and you're done. It's not like that process would have looked a whole lot different if we weren't all in lockdown. At the same time, it is worth underscoring that because of the firm's portfolio right now, it likely could have raised much more. With private company darlings that include DoorDash, which is ostensibly worth $16 billion right now, along with Airtable, valued in the low billions of dollars, and another, newer company, Postman, that just closed a $150 million round last month, CRV seems to be doing just fine. In fact, we really enjoy talking with one of the firm's general partners, John Auerbach, who said they kept the fund at $600 million, the same size as their last vehicle, to make a statement about other venture funds that have grown too large. I think it's something certainly that a lot of longtime industry observers would and do say. Specifically, I hear over and over again that venture capital is not scalable. Does that mean things are broken? I don't know, but I do think it's pretty clear that whereas a $600 million venture fund can conceivably return 4x, 5x, 6x, I think a lot of these bigger firms are just aiming to return 2x their money. And that must be enough for institutional investors that don't see a lot of other good places to grow their money right now. Speaking of criticizing VCs, we also covered another new fund this week, that of Kitty Kaluri, who was a veteran investor who previously spent 11 years with NEA and who struck out on his own in late 2016 to hang his own shingle. Now his firm, Neotribe, has closed on $216 million, though he says Neotribe too could have raised much more and didn't. Kaluri is interesting. He talks a big game, but he also has a lot of top founders wanting to work with him, including veteran entrepreneur Bill Gross, and more recently, two Amazon veterans who have a new company, Vendia, that could probably have gotten funded by any of the bigger brand venture firms, and turned to him instead. I also enjoyed my chat with him. We talked a lot about venture and his concerns that it's grown too bloated. We also talked about M&A slowing down, with the biggest companies buying fewer and fewer companies. And we talked about the IPO market, with startups staying private too long. I did feel after that conversation like, maybe venture is on the verge of breaking. I guess we'll just have to see how the story plays out over the next year or two, but it's probably as good a lead-in as any for our interview with yet another VC who, again, we enjoy talking with this week, Brad Feld. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Founders Shield has just released its Venture Capital and Private Equity Risk Management Guide, which provides VC and PE firms and their portfolio companies with common claim scenarios and best practice strategies to mitigate risk. Download your free copy at foundershield.com.
And now our conversation with Brad Feld, the entrepreneur, author, blogger, and venture capitalist. Brad has a new book coming out called The Startup Community Way, Evolving an Entrepreneurial Ecosystem. We talked with Brad about it and much more.
Brad, we ask everybody how they're doing and how they're coping with what's going on out there. And so we're just curious about how you're dealing with COVID and how it's affecting not only your business, but also your personal life.
My short answer is I feel very fortunate. Amy and I don't have kids, just the two of us. We love being together all the time. So the idea of being in one place 24 hours a day, 7 days a week is kind of a joy for us. I've had a lot of ups and downs since March. The last time I left my house was March 11th, and we've only left three times. The positive is the sense of privilege to be able to live that way. The other end of the spectrum is all of the dissonance in the world. I wrote a post called The Three Crises, and I asserted that there were three crises going on. I think there's at least four. The first was the health crisis. The second is an economic crisis triggered by the health crisis. The third is a mental health crisis, which is we're not used to 24 hours a day in our houses and all those dynamics around that. And then, of course, with George Floyd murder, it generated another crisis in terms of racial equity. And none of these are new crises, right? They're ones that are always ebbing and flowing and going on in different ways and different shapes. But the intensity of them colliding at the same time was a lot. And there's been a lot of work, but also a lot of reflection that Amy and I have engaged with across a couple of different things. And I think there's been parts of that that's been good and helpful and parts of it which has been very, very exhausting, just trying to process and understand and react. I'm very scared of the disease. I don't know if we've ever talked about this. My clinical anxiety disorder is obsessive compulsive disorder. So I'm just fearful. I get very anxious when I'm anywhere around anyone else. And so deciding not to be around people lowers my anxiety a lot. But all things considered, I'm in a very safe and comfortable place.
How would you rate Colorado on the whole?
I think we've done pretty well. Jared, our governor, has done a great job. Colorado is a complicated state for two reasons. One is classic rural-urban dynamic, but the cities are a lot of the population center. And rural Colorado is a mix of Republicans and Democrats, but I'd say it's generally libertarian-leaning versus hard Republican-leaning. I'd say people in Colorado tend to be pretty respectful and thoughtful of each other, which is important for this. There are pockets where it's not, but the challenge we have is because Colorado is such a huge tourism place and a destination place, there's a huge influx right now of people from outside Colorado that just need to get away and get to the mountains.
Right.
Or have second homes in the mountains. We have a place in Aspen that I'm afraid to go to. We're not going to go there this summer. And my friends who live in Aspen say it's horrible. It's overcrowded. Some people are respecting distancing and masks, but the Texans aren't. And there's a very, very large Texas contingent. There's a big New York contingent. And the scene in a place like Aspen is all about the outdoors and the restaurants. And so when there's not compliance at that level, it's very uncomfortable.
Sure. Oh, interesting.
The other piece is we have a very decentralized state. So the public health departments are very county-based, police enforcement, very county-based. We have 64 counties, and so it's very distributed. Mm-hmm. But I feel like we've done a good job.
Well, I guess it's a good segue into the book that you're about to publish with co-author Ian Hathaway about startup ecosystems and how they create value and unfold through a continual process of bottom-up interactions. How does this book differ from the one that you wrote in 2012, Brad? And has anything fundamentally changed?
The book I wrote in 2012, Startup Communities, essentially codified the notion of a startup community because prior to that, that phrase wasn't used. And the interesting thing for me that motivated that book was the combination of us coming out of the global financial crisis and people saying innovation and entrepreneurship is a path forward. There was this beginning of the real reemergence in 2010. Even then, though, there was still this assertion that if you want to build an entrepreneurial company, you needed to be in Silicon Valley. Yeah, you know, I've lived in Boulder since 1995, so that wasn't my viewpoint. I think you can build great companies in the Bay Area, but it's not the only place to build great companies. And I've been involved in it all over the U.S., many different places. The book in 2012 was motivated by trying to help people understand how to build a startup community wherever they were, in any city that had at least 100,000 people like Boulder, and more importantly, why it was important to build a startup community wherever they were. The view of what I did in that book was come up with a pretty simple thesis, which I called the Boulder thesis. I then had this experience with Techstars as Techstars expanded globally around the world. Now it runs about 50 accelerators each year. And I spent a lot of time thinking about how startup communities were growing and developing now that it wasn't a new thing. Mm-hmm. In 2017, Ian and I started working on this book, and we wrote 30,000 words with the goal of answering, I've been at this for 5 years, what now? One day, Ian called me and he said, I've come up with the way to think about what a startup community is. I said, okay. And he said, it's a complex adaptive system. And I knew some about complexity theory from the 1980s and the Santa Fe Institute. And I'd always been intellectually interested in it, but I hadn't gone deep on it. It was startling how well the way complex systems work maps to how startup communities work. And the key word is evolve, because complex systems evolve. Anybody who's in tech that knows Game of Life, understands emergent behavior, these are all language from complexity, right? Positive feedback loops, phase changes, contagion. One of the problems I think that a lot of people in and around startup communities were running into was they were looking for a playbook. And I think I did a pretty good job in the first book of saying it's not a playbook. This is a thesis. Here's some parameters and some things you have to do, but then you have to go figure it out for yourself. The Boulder startup community is going to look different than the New York startup community is going to look different than the Des Moines startup community. But I didn't really give a reason why that was true. I just asserted it. And so this book is going much, much deeper, a little bit more intellectual, but with more texture around how to develop and evolve a startup community using this framework of how complex systems work.
Can you give an example of how an entrepreneur could use the notion of a complex system to help grow their business?
Sure. The fascinating thing is to understand the dynamics that so many of the things that we deal with are complex systems. The starting point for that is probably a very, very straightforward distinction between three types of systems: a simple, complicated, and complex. As humans, we fall into the trap over and over again of trying to take systems and make them simpler or even complicated, and also extrapolating linearly from the things that we're doing. And so we think about everything as though it's a linear progression rather than some other type of progression, which has geometric characteristics. Complex systems almost always are nonlinear in nature. A simple system is making a cup of coffee. Yeah, there's multiple different ways to make a cup of coffee, but it's pretty simple. And it's a straightforward set of steps. You put beans in, a machine, and out comes coffee, and the coffee might be good, the coffee might be bad, but it's coffee. A complicated system for the entrepreneurs out there would be like doing your monthly financial statements. You don't have to get the process in a certain sequence, but there's a set of rules, and in the end, you have a deterministic solution. You get your financial statements. Making an airplane, if you want to create a new Boeing airplane, the Boeing 797, designing it is really hard. It takes a long time. But once you've built that set of plans for how you build a Boeing 797, you can just do it over and over and over again by following the rule book. Raising a child is a complex system. There is no playbook, right? There's no way to say, all right, you're born, and when you're 18, you're going to be this, and when you're 27, you're going to be this. That's not how it works. Part of the way to simplify that explanation is to think about anything you're doing as a series of hypotheses. You have a hypothesis, you run an experiment. If the hypothesis fails or you invalidate the hypothesis, you stop and you learn and you adjust. If the hypothesis works, you do more of it. Well, that's how you build a business, right? A business is an endless series of small experiments, many of which fail. And if you think about the interaction of those things, many of the experiments are not discrete. They have lots of dependencies, including dependencies on things that are completely exogenous to you. If you were thinking about doing a set of things on February 15th, 2020, you probably were thinking about doing a different set of things on April 15th because of the COVID crisis. I would say every single company in our portfolio that I can think of, when COVID hit, we told them all, just throw your plan away. It's completely wrong. Yeah. And it's not going to help you. What you need now is very short-term situational awareness. And you need to understand what's going on as things unfold day by day, because they unfold in ways we can't predict in any way, shape, or form. That's a complex system. Now, there's lots of people who would like to prognosticate and suggest that they know what's going to happen. There's lots of people who would
They're all on Twitter, by the way.
Of course, right? Why wouldn't they be on Twitter? They're also on TV, right? You see an awful lot of that. You see a lot of people who desperately want to control things. We will open schools in the fall. Maybe, right? But maybe not. Right. Another notion of a complex system is a delay. COVID is the ultimate delay. You can't possibly know what the impact of what you do today is for 2 weeks. All the behavior between now and 2 weeks from now just affects the behavior two more weeks out. I heard a crazy thing that's just an example that helps you understand how people don't get this. When things started to open up again, within about 2 or 3 days, people said, well, COVID isn't going up yet. It looks like the opening's going well. I'm like, 2 days? This thing takes 7 to 10 days to show up. You can be asymptomatic for 5 to 7 days. Then after about 2 or 3 weeks, when things are starting to spike, everybody said, yeah, things are starting to spike a little bit here and there, but the death rates are still really low. They're not spiking. Like, wait a second. You don't die the next 24 hours. The disease is really smart. It knows that if it kills you really quickly, it's not going to spread. Right. And so all of a sudden, 6 weeks after things started to loosen up, we have states that are at ICU bed capacity again. What I think a lot of people are starting to understand, especially in this moment, or I hope a lot of people are understanding in this moment, is that many of the really interesting positive things, as well as the interesting negative things, are a function of the interaction effects between stuff, a la a complex system, versus the individual things. And I think I didn't realize that the book would be coming out in the middle of this collision of these incredible complex systems. But as a result, it's very generalizable, and that's pretty fun.
Entrepreneurs have to deal with these complex systems, and there are outcomes that they can't necessarily control. But on the other hand, they only have a certain amount of cash. So how do they balance that need to manage these complex systems with the fact that controlling these complex systems is out of their hands?
I would say step one is get rid of the notion that you can control the systems and instead focus on what you can influence. An example of this would be if you have not asked your existing investors directly how much money they have reserved for you for future financings and what you need to do to get that money from them, you're not focusing on what you can influence, right? The worst thing your investor can do is say, I'm not going to tell you that. But if your investor is really on your side and wants to see you be successful, it's likely your investor will say, all right, well, you know, there might be some wishy-washy and ranges and non-committal language, but you'll at least have a frame of reference, whether that's $0, a little bit of money, or a lot of money. So assume you're a company that is negatively impacted by COVID. Step one that hopefully you did 2 months ago was aggressively cut your cost structure to make your cash last as long as it could. And then next, make sure you understand with your investors what the expectations going forward are. I think there's going to be a whole category of companies that get an asterisk for their 2020 performance. It's kind of like, you know, a sports season that gets cut short. They're just not going to measure the numbers for 2020. Anybody that played in the NBA in 2020 on the back of their basketball card or their online stats can be a little asterisk because it's less games. And there's going to be a lot of companies where investors are measuring your 2019 to 2021 performance because 2020 has an asterisk on it. And so if you're a company that falls in that category, growth in 2020 is not the key thing. The key thing is not running out of money. And the trade-off between trying to grow your business, especially if you're spending money irrationally to try to generate growth, which a lot of companies have been doing the last few years, right? Spending lots and lots of money because investors valued growth over all else, all of a sudden changing that dynamic, again, something that you do have under your control, and focusing your efforts on improving your product and really making sure that what you're doing is going to work well and be relevant in a post-COVID world versus have the assumption that, all right, well, this is going to go on for 3 or 4 months and then we're just going to go back to where we were before and everything's going to work the same way. Those would be examples of how the exogenous impacts you and you can then react to it in a way that you have under your control, even if you don't like the information, right? When you call your investor up and say, hey, will you share with me how you're thinking about it? And the investor says a bunch of stuff that you don't like, tough. It's data. You don't have to like it. Now you have the data. And now you can start to make rational decisions based on data. By the way, it doesn't mean that you have to accept the data. You can argue, you can challenge, you can evolve and show new information that causes that opinion or the data to change. When I reflect on our portfolio, the CEOs in our portfolio who are doing the best job navigating through this, either on the upside where their businesses are benefiting or where they've been impacted, are being assertive about trying to continue the situational awareness with us and with them. Because by the way, the companies that are benefiting from this could also all of a sudden see that stop. Assuming that those things are going to continue forever is another problem with essentially linear thinking, which is that some of these things go away pretty quickly. Everything looks a certain way until the day it isn't. Mm-hmm. Right? On February 15th, if you'd said to someone, I think the vast majority of the people who work in offices around the world are going to be working from home for the next couple of months, any human being on planet Earth would have said, you got to be kidding me. Right? No way. Another example of that that's one of my favorites is telemedicine. Telemedicine made 10 years of progress in 4 weeks. The technology existed. The software existed. Humans could do behavioral telemedicine. And by the way, the worst place in the world to go in the second half of March and the first half of April was a hospital. Right. Well, voila. The federal government says, you know what, all those rules and regulations we have around telemedicine and HIPAA, and you can't use Skype and you can't use this and you can't forget that for the time being. And then state government starts saying, you know what, anything you can do, Mr. Hospital System, to be able to treat patients without having them come in, better. And then hospital systems start saying, you know what, we're screwed. We have no revenue coming in because we can't do elective surgeries. We got a bunch of doctors that can't do anything. You know what, let's try to actually see some patients. And let's use telemedicine. Voila, 4 weeks later, that happens. Now, we would have got there maybe over the next 5 years, but we had this massive phase shift that happened as a result of this thing that occurred in a very short period of time. That happens over and over again with innovation.
Brad, I had my first and I guess last event of the year in March. It was going to be a real world event that was moved online. And Alexis Ohanian was one of the guests. And this was March 25th. And I remember him saying, some founders are just going to have to take their seed funding and pivot entirely and do something that makes sense for this environment. And I thought that sounded dramatic at the time. Of course, now I think he was right. I'm just wondering, have you had any of your seed funded founders completely shake off what they were doing and reinvent their companies?
Separate seed from early stage, because at this point, Foundry Group doesn't have a lot of seed investments. Most of our seed exposure is through the venture funds that we're LPs in. Now 25% of our capital gets invested in other funds. And we've been doing that since 2016, and we've got a little bit over 30 funds that we're LPs in. And most of them are pre-seed and seed type investors. And then, of course, we have very large seed exposure through our investment in Techstars. In our portfolio directly, I don't think of anyone who has torn up their business plan and said, this isn't going to work. We're going to do something totally different. We do have a number of companies that very aggressively stopped doing sets of things, whether it was pursuing new products, expanding into new markets, trying to go down a particular path that was additive to what they were doing. And then we had several companies that had to reposition something really dramatically. A good example of that would be Formlabs. They're one of the largest desktop 3D printer companies, Boston-based, doing very well. A chunk of their business was the dental market. And they had a lot of dental labs buy Formlabs printers. They had bought a manufacturing facility, so they have a lot of bio-certified resins, and they could make on a service bureau basis, or they could sell printers to the dental industry, and they're the market leader in that category. When everybody starts shutting down, dentists are shut down. They're not essential, right? You can't go to dentists. And that market went to zero overnight. Instead of rolling up and saying, oh, woe is me, they looked at the need for certain things in the context of COVID. And they realized that one of the immediate shortages in COVID was swabs for doing PCR testing. It turns out that on Formlabs printers using their bio-certified products, you can print lots of swabs. And in fact, the printer farm that they have can print about 100,000 swabs a day. And so they started printing swabs. They did a deal with one of their customers that was a hospital to get them certified. They designed them. They tested them. They went through the whole certification process that they needed to go through very quickly. All of a sudden, they started supplying swabs. Hospitals started realizing, we can print the swabs ourselves if we just have a Formlabs printer. And so they focused that part of their business that previously sold to dental labs to sell to hospitals. And it's been a rapidly growing part of their business. Some of it was situational awareness, but some of it was also just being very smart in the moment and saying, all right, we're not going to try to do unnatural things here, but we're also not going to panic and freak out and say, oh my God, our business doesn't work anymore. We've got this money in the bank. We got to figure out what to do. Back to the original question, the really good entrepreneurs, regardless of the stage they're at, including very early stage, take a deep breath and try to focus on what they can impact, work closely and communicate really well with their investors and their board about what they're thinking, get lots of feedback, but don't overreact in the moment, yet react quickly.
Brett, one question in my mind is, what's going to happen with all of these more newly funded companies? In the Strictly VC newsletter, my smaller funding section has gotten longer and longer in recent months. And I can see VCs doing deals with these companies because they're relatively low risk. So even if you can't maybe meet the founders and form a more full-bodied relationship with them, you can write them a check. But I'm wondering what's going to happen if this drags on.
I have for a long time believed the opposite of conventional wisdom, which is in VC, you need to be close to the physical location of the companies you invest in. I've never had that be the case. I've always invested around the U.S. and Foundry and my partners have always invested all around the U.S. We for sure have companies in Colorado, but we don't concentrate on investing in all the companies in Colorado. We concentrate on investing in companies that fit within our themes. Some of the best investments I've done were done without ever meeting the founders in person until after I made the investment. My favorite example of that one is Fitbit, where I don't think I met James and Eric until probably 3 to 6 months after we had closed the investment. Now, I spent plenty of time with them on video and lots of email interactions and lots of product interactions prior to the investment. But the physical meeting was not the important thing to me. That's a way of existing. And I think for many, many, many investors and also for many entrepreneurs, that has been hard. Interestingly, if you asked entrepreneurs, hey, how do you feel about being beckoned to investors' offices to pitch them, I think most entrepreneurs don't love that. I think we're in a place now where investors in general are going to be more comfortable making investments this way. There's a lot of great VCs who go to entrepreneurs, and they're the ones, I think, that develop really strong relationships that also don't have to be physical in-person relationships. And they're not mutually exclusive things, but I think it gives those investors an advantage in this kind of environment. And hopefully entrepreneurs will recognize over a period of time that the notion that they have to physically continue to go to the investor is not necessarily a good use of time.
And you think that's true despite check size?
Yeah, in some ways, the larger the check size, the less that matters. If you think about later stage deals and larger check sizes, an awful lot of that has a lot less to do than the in-person and a lot more to do with the financial analysis, demand dynamics of around, the type of ways that people want to allocate money. And interestingly, I think that there's lots of biases that get introduced into the mix by being in person. And those biases are both directions. Those biases are the in-person bias that happens when you have a frame of reference of how someone's going to behave, look, be like in person, and they're different. And then just the general biases of networks, which I think in our industry has been very well called out. After the George Floyd murder, I sat down and I wrote down a list of all of the people who I considered to be close friends who were Black. Close friends, not acquaintances or people I knew or somebody in my LinkedIn. It was a, for me, very disappointingly short list. It wasn't zero, but it was short. Mm-hmm. And secondarily, it was all men. And I looked at that and I thought to myself, something's wrong. The problem is me. Mm-hmm. And so as you think about that dynamic and the biases that get built into networks, an overused word that is a falsehood is the word meritocracy. In our society today, the justification for so much behavior at any level is it's a meritocracy. And in fact, it's a justification in some ways for perpetuating bias and exclusion. Late stage rounds have a lot less to do with the people, and they have a lot more to do with the mechanics of the business. And so in some ways, the in-person bias dynamics become less important.
Speaking of diversity, I did want to ask, because you are a VC and an LP, how do you think we solve this problem? I had posed maybe a month or so ago that LPs change LPA agreements, that they have to, the VCs have to sort of fund a certain amount of people of color or women, because then maybe they'll be more incentivized to make those relationships work rather than throwing a few dollars here and there. I also talked to Michael Kim recently, and he suggested raising more people up through the ranks of LPs, making these people associates from historically Black colleges. What do you think the solution is?
The frame of reference I have for this comes from my experience with gender and gender in tech. It's the analogy I've used for myself for racial equity in tech and entrepreneurship. I started to be involved in gender equity in tech in 2005. The way I got involved was a woman named Lucy Sanders, who was the CEO of National Center for Women Information Technology, ncwit.org. I told Lucy, I'm in. I'll help in any way I can. I had a bunch of hypotheses on day one. Within 6 months, I learned very quickly that virtually everything that I thought or knew was incorrect. All of the anecdotes that I had heard or been exposed to were at best neutral, and many of them were harmful. Most men who showed up, and in this case, white men who showed up around the problem, all had suggestions and ideas. Most of them were wrong or not helpful. Many of them had language around things like fixing and broken, where there was an implication that women were the problem or that women were broken and needed to be fixed, and reinforce this one up, one down relationship between the men and the women, and on and on and on. So within 6 months, I realized that the very first thing I needed to do was a combination of deeply engage with women and support them in their endeavors, whatever those endeavors were, and learn. I take that mindset to the question you just asked, which is, I don't think that anything that I would suggest as a solution right now is valid. I think that I can come up with lots of hypotheses, but really the way I approached this right after George Floyd got murdered, I reached out to about 15 people over the course of the next week. I asked them all one question. And the question was, what are two things that you're involved in right now that I can bring the three resources I have, money, time, and influence? I said, I don't want to create anything new unless you want to create something new. I don't want it to be my thing. And I don't want to just give you money. I want to support you in whatever way is helpful to you accomplishing whatever your goals are. I have to change my own behavior, change my own perspective, engage deeply and learn from my Black and brown friends and build networks. And from that, learn what to do and help and support as an advocate.
When you're talking about women and having this eye-opening experience, thanks to this friend of yours who started this organization, has that impacted the number of women that you funded at Foundry? And I guess, do you have data now to support your decisions to potentially back women in the future? Because I think a lot of the problem with doing anything new is VCs are so data reliant. And until they do these things, there's no data to underscore that these are good investments.
In the startup community way, Ian and I spend a lot of time talking about something we call the measurement trap. We've been so programmed that if you don't measure it, you can't manage it. What we lose sight of is if you measure the wrong thing and then you build your activity on the measurement of the wrong thing, you will fail. And unfortunately, most people measure the easy stuff. And most people default into measurements that are either presented to them or for some reason, from their own biases, they think they should be measuring. And in the context of startup communities, most of those measurements are just not that important. They don't matter. They don't have much impact on what's actually happening in the startup community. They're often used to justify behavior, make people feel good, get additional budget or allocation. So when I look back, for example, at what we've done at Foundry in terms of investing in women, I don't think that we've done nearly as good a job as we could have. However, we have plenty of companies that have women CEOs or women founders. The place where I think we have been weak is if you look at the boards. Our boards are not very female-centric. If you look at our management teams, many of those management teams are still very male-heavy. Mm-hmm. You know these things, but then you end up playing out a different script. So one of the challenges, I think, for our industry as a whole, both around gender and race, is to figure out how to stop playing those scripts. Now, I think I've learned a lot from Lucy and from NCWIT, and some of the things we've done at Foundry and many of the things that we've done at Techstars have actually been very positive on this dimension. I don't know if this or not, but at Techstars, about 5 years ago, we started something called the Techstars Foundation, a nonprofit that the Techstars founders contributed some money to, and we've subsequently raised a good chunk of money for. And its mission is to increase diversity in entrepreneurship. Have we done an awesome job at that? We're the exemplar organization for the planet for that? No. But has that changed behavior at Techstars, where there's much more understanding of, focus on, engagement with these issues? Totally. And one of the things I think that's part of my startup community thesis generally, and is a key part of startup community way, is that you just have to have a long-term view for these things. And as part of having a long-term view, you have to work on it continuously for a long period of time. This is where I think the ultimate trap is, especially around measurement. Our short attention spans get in our way. I think that there's probably plenty of people in the VC industry who actually don't think that there's an economic benefit to more diverse teams, or they really view that it's a meritocracy, or their biases inhibit their ability to see past them and think about a different kind of world. And that's reality. That's just part of how our world works. I am not casual about that, but I'm realistic about it. And so then my view is what I can do, what my partners can do, what the people I'm involved in can do, tends to be bottom up instead of top down. When I think about how startup communities evolve, it's bottom up phenomena. The more you try to put rules on top of it that say this is how these things have to work, the less effective that is. If you can put energy in and modify things from the bottom up over a long period of time with focus and consistency, good stuff happens. And that's how I'm thinking about it.
I certainly hope people don't get too distracted from this important issue.
I can't imagine how we would, given that in the U.S. there's an election thing or something coming up, right? I mean, I'm being sarcastic. Like, it's so nuts.
Of course.
It's so nuts. Look, NCWIT's 15 years old. If you said to Lucy, have you accomplished everything you wanted to accomplish? She'd say, no way.
Right.
Is it a lot better today than it was 15 years ago? And she'd say, yeah, it's a lot better. Are the measurements all up and to the right? I think she'd say, some are, some aren't, but most don't matter. If you look at actually the way that the system is changing, it's changing.
Brad, I know we have to let you go, and I'm so appreciative of your being generous with your time. I have to ask, are you on Clubhouse?
No. What's Clubhouse?
I love you even more now.
No, I'm not on Clubhouse. I have no interest in Clubhouse. If somebody invites me to Clubhouse, I'll ignore the invite. Not interested. I wasn't on Secret either. Wasn't that a thing?
You really
for a
missed
while?
The boat on that too.
Whoa, yeah. No, but I'm not interested. I'm very happy with my email address. And if people want to email me, that's the easiest way to get me. And I don't have to be part of a club.
That's great. Brad, thank you
so
much.
What's the Groucho Marx line? Any club that would have me,
I don't want to be part of. Exactly. Okay, Brad. Well, I hope it's not too long before we catch up again. Really nice seeing you and talking to you.
Connie, always great to see you. And Alex, nice to meet you.
Yeah. Thank
and
you.
Take good care of each other in this moment. Be safe.
That's it for this episode. If you like what you're hearing, please don't hesitate to rate Strictly VC Download on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Yes, thanks everyone. We'd appreciate it. Also, for the founders that are listening, check out TechCrunch's early stage event happening on Tuesday and Wednesday of this coming week. We will be a part of that. I will be helping to interview Jess Lee of Sequoia Capital along with her colleague James Buckhouse, also Gary Tan of Initialized Capital, and Preeti Yosef Choksi of Norwest Venture Partners. You can actively participate in this one. You don't have to be a mushroom. There's going to be a lot of Q&A opportunities, and if I were a founder, I would want to tune in. So please do. Thanks.